Hi, welcome to True Creeps, where the stories are true and the creeps are real. We'll cover stories from grotesque gore to the possibly plausible paranormal, to horrifying history, to tense and terrible true crime, and everything else that goes bump in the night. We're your hosts, Amanda.
And I'm Lindsay. And we want you to join us while we creep.
We cover mature topics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about an infamous unsolved case from the late 1800s. It's been dubbed the Wallingford Shoebox Murder. As with many of the old cases that we've covered, sources vary on the details. We'll note the inconsistencies as they come up, but it is a little strange. Some of the inconsistencies are even between newspapers from the time.
And we've seen that before, too, where they're like, we heard it this way, so this is the way we're going to write about it. Or this is more exciting.
Exactly. They're like, this is a little bit more sensational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But before we get into it, we're going to talk a little bit about the area and what life was like there during that time. It's 1886. We're in Wallingford, Connecticut. It went from a farming town to an industrial hub, specifically for the metal industry. There was an abundance of factories, mills, blacksmiths.
So completely opposite of what it started with. Yeah.
There was still a lot of farming communities there.
Yeah. Yeah. When you said there were still farms, in my head, I saw they had metal farms.
Oh, shit. Like, they're just like harvesting steel.
Yeah.
They're picking little silver berries off of plants.
Yeah.
Shaking the gold orchard, if you will.
Yep. That's what happened. That's Wallingford, Connecticut.
That's how metals. So in the area, working class families worked at the mills and factories. The middle and upper class families were people who owned more land, and they were also the owners of the factories and mills and the banks and all the other businesses that popped up because there were factories.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason for that industrial shift was because a train station was established there in 1871. And as we've seen with a lot of the things that we talk about, where a train station was added to an area, it always boosts it. The town significantly changes and people are traveling there more.
It's easier.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I mentioned it a second ago, but more industry means more taverns, more inns, more businesses that would thrive with travelers and with people who have a more disposable income.
Right. But hopefully they named their inns appropriately.
Yeah. Like, what, community hotel? It doesn't make any sense.
Not community hotel.
Cottage hotel? It doesn't make sense. It's a different type of building. I stand by it. I stand on business. I think that's what the kids might say. I don't know. I could be wrong on that. But I stand on it. I stand on hotels being named not dumb names. And I will never not be critical of it.
You can tell that we just got done with the doll chat because I'm still in doll world here.
Oh, yeah. We're in like just chaos mode. And everyone knows, if you're thinking chaotic, let's talk about the 1800s, you know?
Yeah, of course. And train stations.
Look, I like to talk about a train. You know I do. In addition to trains, just we're thinking dirt roads, gas lamps, horse-drawn wagons, just real old-timey 1800 shit.
Evil horses.
Perhaps haunted horses, evil horses. We don't know. I'm sure there were highwaymen, if there's a carriage, you know? That's the vibe.
For sure-sies, yeah.
In Wallingford, but also pretty much everywhere in the United States, there was this brewing tension between classes because people who were working at factories were working grueling hours. They're working well over an 8-hour workday, doing hard manual labor. And there's really no recognition of that, of the fact that it is not only just tiring, but dangerous to work long hours at a factory because you're more likely to get injured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
The communities themselves were close-knit, but especially between the different classes.
Yeah. So let's talk about what happened on August 8th of 1886. A young boy named Edward Terrell and his dog found something odd tucked into a huckleberry bush off a logging road in Wallingford. People now call the road Shoebox Road. Lindsay, is that an appropriate name in your book or no?
Yes, it is. Approved. Stamped.
That one works. Okay. Approved. Thank you. And what Edward found was about a 30-inch by 12-inch wooden crate that had a label on it that said, quote, a dozen pairs of fine-stitched men's shoes.
A bizarre thing to find under a huckleberry bush.
Yeah, very weird. And it wasn't a cryptid like we were talking about in the bushes before.
Yeah, yeah.
This time it's just a crate. Anyways, if you're not sure what 30-inch by 12-inch would be, because, like, who would? Who would know?
Yeah, who could know that?
That's about 3/5 of a 12-year-old boy by 1/4 of a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying that our 12-year-old boy math isn't creepy, but it feels extra weird when we're talking like a fraction of a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
At least with 1.5, there's one whole 12-year-old boy. But when we're like, 3/5, feels a bit strange.
Yeah. But everyone gets it now.
Yeah. But like they couldn't understand.
Everyone could picture exactly how big this crate is. Yeah.
Like inches. I mean, come on.
This is going to be the new measuring.
Yeah.
Okay. Listen up, scientists and mathematicians.
Yeah.
So Edward's dog started sniffing around the box and whining as they approached it. Edward noticed that it had an odd smell, too. He pried the box open and there were shoes in there. But there weren't just shoes. There was also a headless human torso that was wrapped in tar paper. Now, what the fuck is tar paper, right? I had no idea. Tar paper was used for wrapping and shipping goods, often used for perishable items, and it helped with any liquid seepage.
We don't like that phrase.
Just the word liquid seepage.
I know. Mm-mm. It's an uncomfortable phrase.
Yeah, yeah. Ugh. There was also blood-soaked straw in the box as well. Based on the amount of blood, law enforcement concluded that the torso was likely put into the crate immediately after it was dismembered.
Okay. Okay. So, okay. What's in the box?
I knew that was coming at some point.
It had to, right? It had to. So, newspapers from this time paint the story a bit differently than modern sources. In some articles, it wasn't Edward who opened the box, but rather he was suspicious of the box and then told some men they came and they opened it. And in this telling, Edward didn't open the box because remember that smell Amanda mentioned a moment ago? Mm-hmm. He could smell it and he recognized the smell of a decomposing human body.
Of course, all kids do.
Of course, because just a few weeks prior, he had found another dead body while walking his dog.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and this was like in newspaper articles. And the other person he found was named Mrs. McKiernan and was found pretty close to where the crate was found. I'm just going to say it. I think his dog might be a cadaver dog. What are the odds? Like, there's not that many people dying in Wallingsford.
So unlucky.
Just out in the woods, hopefully, that you just can't help but stumble upon them. But fuck.
Yeah, I would think that maybe there was a lot of death then at this point if this boy is just finding dead body after dead body.
Right? Right? Well, the other person they identified didn't say she was murdered or anything like that. I think she was just dead in the woods.
No, she just naturally died.
Maybe she was an old lady.
Maybe.
So let's talk about what happens next with the investigation. We're talking about August 10th to August 15th. Again, it's 1886. And the local coroner examined the torso and he made some determinations. So first, that it was a 20 to 40 year old woman who likely died of arsenic poisoning and had likely been dead for 10 to 15 days. Some sources say the stomach was removed from the torso and sent off for testing, and that's how they confirmed the arsenic poisoning. Other sources say that in the stomach, there was a large amount of arsenic.
Yikes.
Either way, the torso itself was buried the next day. They were like, okay, we've seen enough of this. They bury the torso. They would later determine that the victim was a man. And just as a reminder, all that was in that box was a headless torso. So there wasn't any reproductive organs for them to make a determination about. They were making their determination solely based on the size of the victim and like the lack of hair. We'll talk more about other parts they find later that also suggest that it was a slighter and smaller person. So woman, a small man, question mark. We don't really know because that was one of the limitations of that time. When we say torso, we truly mean no arms, cut off at the neck, cut off like above the pelvis. So you can't see what's going on there.
I mean, I guess it was decomposing too. So it'd be kind of hard to tell for the top half as well.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like whether there were breasts. I think that they were just a slight person. So depending on how the tissue slippage was, it may have been unclear.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like because it was decomposing.
My brain completely forgot about breasts for a minute. Clearly. Because I was like, what do you mean? What wouldn't they have seen? But I think that their person was just very slight and they were like delicate looking is how they described it. So it also could have been that like they just didn't have a large chest generally either way.
Yeah.
So eventually, though, the coroner revised the report to say that it was a man. But many people still believed that the person that was found was a woman.
It's interesting that others would even have a thought about it because it's not like everyone went and saw it.
No, it wasn't like Villisca where everybody was like just like tromping through the house. But I think that because it was a time when it was a visual inspection and absent visible indicators of biological sex, you can't really see them. So if there's no breasts, if there's no genitals,
yeah,
how would you know?
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. So we were kind of curious, like, how they made any determinations about bodies in 1886 when they happen upon dead bodies, or this boy continually happens upon dead bodies. Not necessarily for this particular victim, but they would look at dental health to help determine the age of the victim. And so they'd look at the wear of the teeth, the enamel, the color, the gum recession. And in our case today, obviously the head was missing, so they couldn't determine the age of the body here
from the teeth.
They'd also look at the bones, and they'd look at the fusion of the growth plates to help determine age. We talked about that a little bit in the solder episode a while back.
Mm-hmm.
They'd also look at bone density and joint wear. For time of death, what they look at is the color of the skin, the amount of bloating, tissue slippage. And we've talked about that too many times, I feel like. I just don't even like saying it.
Yeah, I don't either. But I feel like it's an important thing to note because I hopefully we'll all die at some point because immortality sounds like a fucking drag. But it's just what the body does. So you can become dirt so plants can grow. This is part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what it is, for those that haven't listened to the other episodes where we detail by detail talk about it, but it's when the skin basically detaches from the underlying tissue during decomposition. And typically it's more noticeable in the hands and the feet. Another way that they determine time of death is by the odor intensity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds awful. It's just like what it sounds like, the strength of the smell of the body's decomposition. No, thank you. How they determine the cause of death. If the coroner noted that the remains had internal hemorrhaging or organ erosion, they may have suspected arsenic. They also had something called the Marsh test, and that was invented in 1836 and used in the 1880s. And that test converts arsenic in tissue to arsine gas, then to metallic arsenic, producing a silvery black deposit.
Science, science.
Science, science. Yeah, in the 1800s, you just don't really think of that. But obviously,
yeah,
they weren't helpless. Like, they did know some things back in the 1800s. It just,
yeah, yeah.
When you think about it now, it just seems so old-timey. And this would require a chemist or a skilled physician, obviously, because it's science, science. These science people would have been available in New England urban centers like New Haven or Hartford.
Yeah, because like Wallingford was still up and coming. While they were becoming an industrial hub, they weren't as big as like the nearby cities still. So it's a little bit unclear whether they used that or not, too.
Right. But it was there. It was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know if they used it, but it was available, or at least the test existed at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like thinking of this, we were also like, okay, well, what investigative tools do we have now that they didn't have then that would have perhaps led to them finding out who this person in the box was and who did this? So fingerprinting wasn't used until the 1900s. There was also very little cross-jurisdictional homicide investigation cooperation. And you know what that means. It's time for me to remind you that today, almost 140 years later, we still don't have a mandate that all police departments in the United States utilize our cross-jurisdictional homicide and violent crime investigative tool called VICAP. And what VICAP does is it logs all of the peculiarities about a violent crime so that we can notice trends, so that we can catch people who are doing fucked up shit in different jurisdictions, because they do that often to evade capture. And hello, I know this, so now you have to know it. There is a terrifying backlog of cases to go into VICAP right now, which means that it is the season of the serial killer right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like there's been a time that was quite this ripe for people to get away with murder as we are today. And that is horrifying.
It is. And it's a lot of the time, a lot of jurisdictions, like, they don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Unless VICAP says, hey, there is some similarity, or unless someone puts it together and like throws it in their face, too.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that we are getting to a time period where there's a debate of how ethical true crime content is on a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And we're circling back from, I think that it depends on the media. I think it depends on the content. I think it depends on how you talk about it. There's ways to do it right. There's ways to do it wrong, in my opinion. And when it is justice and victim-centered and kind, I think it's a good thing. And when you are looking to help solve crimes and what we've learned from them over the years, I think that's a different thing than talking about the gore and speaking as though a family member couldn't listen, you know? I think there's just a difference there.
Yeah, yeah.
But we literally need people to be looking at these because there is not enough resources to do this. And that is horrifying.
Well, there could be, but we choose to spend the funding on other ridiculous things.
It seems like there is a hell of a lot of law enforcement energy taken to capture innocent people who are simply living their lives versus actual, literal murderers, robbers, rapists, the fucking worst of the worst.
Yeah.
They're barely being investigated.
Yep.
But all that to say, we'll talk about VICAP in a later episode. But all that to say is that one of the investigative tools that they didn't have in 1886 was the possibility of cross-jurisdictional cooperation for these investigations.
Yeah.
And just on top of it, going back to what we were just saying, is that it was pretty common for coroners to miss the sex of the victims, especially if they didn't have all the body parts, because they didn't have the type of testing that we have today. So, yeah.
Fair, fair. Or, I mean, they could even believe that there might be multiple bodies, too, if the body parts were scattered between the jurisdictions.
Exactly. Exactly.
They may not see it as the same person, nor would they know that there's a foot in one jurisdiction and a torso in another. Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't doing DNA testing. That wasn't possible.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into later in August of 1886. A local resident reported seeing a bag at the bottom of their well. When law enforcement came to check it out, it was gone. Now, there are differing stories about this next part. What we do know is that a piece of human scalp with hair on it was found. It was either found generally around the area where the crate was found, or it was found next to this well. Different sources say different things. So after this time, law enforcement begins to search even more in that wooded area where the crate had been left, and they found arms and legs that were also wrapped in tar paper. Some sources say that it actually wasn't the immediate surrounding area, but that it was a farm and farmers found it. But either way, arms and legs are found. Some sources say tar paper, some sources say partially buried, but they are not with the torso. And in every account,
right,
the head was never found.
Frightening.
Which is frightening on numerous levels, because where is the head? Is that the one part they buried?
Mm-hmm.
Did they keep it? Earlier, we had mentioned that the way that the body was described, but those original reports, especially in like newspapers and stuff like that, they talked about the hands and feet as being dainty. And so that's another reason why people thought that the victim was a woman and kind of had a hard idea revising that idea even once they had new information that suggested otherwise.
Right. So as part of the investigation, they tracked where the crate came from. And the investigators were able to trace the wooden crate because it had a label on it. And it was labeled to contain, quote, a dozen pairs of fine-stitched men's shoes. And they tracked it all the way back to a shoe factory that was located in Fall River, Massachusetts. Interesting note, if that sounds familiar, we've talked about Fall River, and that was in our Bridgewater Triangle episode, and it was the Fall River cult killings episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think of nothing else other than that when I think of Fall River. So per police records, the Fall River Shoe Factory dispatched the crate to a wholesale shoe dealer that was located in Chicago. Once in Chicago, the retailer sold the shoes, they emptied out the crate, and then they placed it behind their store, just like a lot of stores do today, right? When they get shipments of things. A few months later, they sold it to a local man, and that local man later disappeared.
Not surprisingly, some people say he disappeared. Some people are just like, they sold the crate and don't even make mention of the disappearance.
Well, right. And it would be hard to track who they sold it to unless they like kept good records of who they sold crates to.
And why would they do that?
If that wasn't, I mean, they sold shoes usually. Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah. They're like, here's the trash. Like, here's how much I sold the trash for.
Yeah, exactly. It's presumed that the man who purchased the crate shipped the crate to Wallingford, and then it was used to conceal the remains. And we're not sure if it was shipped with the remains or those were added later. I would hope that they were just added later because it would have smelled a little bit, but not that I want remains in crates at all.
Yeah, we don't want crate remains at all, or frankly, murdered body remains. But we'll talk more in a bit about the theory of why it may have been shipped from Chicago specifically. So people in Wallingford began to report some strange sightings, but nearly all of them recanted. So the first was a woman known as Mabel Preston, and she claimed to, quote, know the whole story behind the murder. But when questioned under oath, she retracted her statement. And sadly, 2 years after the remains were found, Mabel died by suicide, which was in 1888. And we did look it up because we were like, was it because she knew something, but there was no evidence that suggested anything suspicious about her suicide. Another woman told law enforcement that a bearded stranger came to her door and asked for directions to the pond. He knocks on her door wearing a bloodstained shirt and carrying a bundle on his back. She didn't know about the pond he was asking about, so she told him about the nearest river instead. And, like, my immediate response upon reading that was, I am simply not going to answer my door, period.
Never.
But also, I'm certainly not going to answer my door if the person on the other side of it is covered in blood. I am going to, however, give you directions to the police station if you ask me for directions to anywhere covered in blood.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
She's like, no big deal. This is normal.
She's like, oh, he just wants to go to the river to wash off the blood. No worries.
Just Wallingford, typical day.
Typical day. The witness said that she later saw him walking back from the other direction, and he had a fresh shirt on and no bundle. But she later recanted her story. And I feel like this is like my gut instinct on that is that she got tired of people asking her about it. And she was like, this is nothing. I don't feel like talking about it.
Probably.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't talk to the guy with the blood in the shirt. I get it. Dumb fucking move. She's like, can you just stop? Like, and everybody was talking about it.
That or she got scared.
Yeah, I mean, she could have gotten scared. And some more on why she may have later, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's talk about who the victim could have been. Early in the investigation, many people thought that the body was Albert J. Cooley. And he took a $1,500 pension from the local slaughterhouse when he went missing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting note. But Albert was ultimately found alive. So he just took his money, ran for a bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There were several fires in the area earlier, and some suspected that the fires were started by a group of people and that the group killed one of the arsonists. Specifically, they thought it was Charles Hull, but this was never confirmed. Some suspected one of the local butchers when one of their employees had went missing, but the missing employee was also found alive too. People just go missing a lot in this town or like leave for a bit and then they're like, hey, I'm still alive, by the way. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are a ton of theories, though, of who it could have been. Just as a little spoiler, there's really no theories that really seem to make that much sense, though.
It's really not.
Interesting. So most of the theories are just motives as to why the person may have been murdered. And we'll share the ones that have enough of a link for us to be even considering them, because a lot of them were just nonsense.
Yeah, it was like, because there was a jealous lover,
mm-hmm.
because they hated their boss. Like, it was like, that's not a theory as to who this is or why. Like, that's just a reason why people murder one another. Don't list that in theories.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So the first theory is the victim was an immigrant or a transient that worked odd jobs at a nearby farm or factory. This was based on the compact build of the remains, the lack of identification, and the rural setting where the remains were found. So, I mean, it could still be anyone, though.
Yeah. They're like, oh, you're tiny. I bet you worked on a farm? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
I know. Another theory is the victim was murdered during the Haymarket Affair of 1886, and it was shipped to Wallingford. But, like, who received it and who was like, this is for the huckleberry bush?
Exactly. Exactly. Like, how did it get to the huckleberry bush? Did it just, like, conveniently fall off of, like, a shipping wagon?
They shipped it.
Yeah.
They shipped it to the huckleberry bush.
Like, care of Logging Road Huckleberry Bush. Delivery instructions were, like, place under.
Yeah.
The 1886 Amazon driver was like, okay, I'll put this under the huckleberry bush.
Yeah, yeah. So proponents of this theory suggest that one of the labor activist leaders may have been murdered, then shipped to Wallingford. Because Connecticut was known to be worse at solving crimes than Illinois was.
What a stretch. What a stretch.
I mean, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Part of the reasoning for this theory is because the crate was last known to be at a retailer in Chicago before it was sold, like we talked about earlier. So they're like, yep, they just shipped it on over.
Yeah. And the Haymarket Affair was a few months before this. So I think that's part of the reason why people think that they're connected. We are not going to pass up literally any opportunity to look into a piece of history that we're unfamiliar with and share it with you. So we're going to talk very briefly about the Haymarket Affair of 1886. So it's also known as the Haymarket Riot, Massacre, Tragedy, or Incident based on your source. So People who were more on the labor side might call it the Haymarket Affair. People who were for the factories would say riot. Much like today.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to say today.
Where some people call it a protest, some people are going to call it a riot. You're going to notice way too many similarities between then and now, unfortunately.
Or gathering, insurrection.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know.
So, in the 1880s, workers across the United States began to demand that their work hours be shortened to 8 hours without a cut in their pay. So they're like, we don't want to work 10-hour days, but we still want to make the wage because that's how we survive.
Yeah.
Many of the activist leaders were white immigrants, but immigrants nonetheless, and the opposition focused on this heavily. They described their quest to have a reasonable workday as un-American and argued that those who were seeking to have a fair, reasonable workday were attempting to corrupt American values. Doesn't that sound painfully familiar? And isn't it interesting that that seems to be a rhetoric that we use over and over again anytime we try to be more fair and kind to workers, is that we often, it circles back to that's un-American. And I would ask you the question of, if it is un-American to be able to work and live a life, is that the America we want to live in?
Right. Who wants that?
Ask yourself that question. Think about that. And whose America is it if what you want is free labor?
Right. And then also, American values is everything put into one, different cultures. And
That's the whole point. It's the whole point of it.
Yeah. It's so interesting that we have that thinking.
Yes.
Where it's like America was founded by so many different places and so many people came to America from all different places. And
America was founded by immigrants.
Yes. It's a jumbled mess here. So like what?
No founding fathers' roots were on the United States soil.
Yes.
They came from Europe.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we really want to go to American values, let's go back to some of the indigenous people that lived here and see the way they lived their life.
But so, okay. We're talking about this labor movement with many social justice movements throughout the years. One of the things that was happening was that racial minorities were often excluded from this movement. And so not only were they excluded from leadership roles, but they were also generally excluded from union efforts. And further, some of the white labor groups advocated for racist policies like excluding Chinese workers. Some were also not just excluding them from unions, but they were proponents of segregated unions. And this was especially problematic because Black, Chinese, and Mexican laborers often worked under harsher conditions than their white counterparts. So not only were they having a harder time generally, but then when it came to making this more fair, making this more just, it was like, but we're not going to include them, which literally, what the fuck?
Yeah, I hate it.
This is like by far not the only movement where this was the case, but it's just disgusting when you're like,
but not them.
But not them. I want to be able to live a quiet and peaceful life. And I think everyone should be able to do it unless your skin color is this.
Yeah.
Unless you come from a country I don't like. Unless I have this prejudice against you.
Yeah.
But anyway, so okay, this labor movement was centralized in Chicago. On May 1st of 1886, workers from all over the country were striking their labor jobs. In Chicago alone, over 80,000 workers went on strike. Now, just a couple days later, on May 3rd of 1886, the Chicago police killed multiple people who were striking at the McCormick harvesting machine plant. So again, we're talking about law enforcement killing strikers, protesters.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Yeah.
The next day, the strikers congregate in Haymarket Square in Chicago to protest the police violence.
Fair.
The event started peacefully with speeches from the labor movement leadership. That starts. And then police began to try to break up the crowd. And it's at this point that someone threw a homemade bomb at the police officers. 7 police officers and 4 civilians were killed. And dozens of other people were hurt as well. A mixture of police officers and civilians.
That's sad.
It's very sad. Ultimately, 8 labor activists were arrested and charged with conspiracy. Although there was no proof that they had thrown the bomb, the trial was highly publicized and there was sparse evidence. 4 of the men, August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fisher, and George Engel, were hanged in 1887, One might say that the reason why there was such a harsh sentence and why there was what many people called a sham trial and such a quick determination of their guilt despite the evidence was to make an example of, like, look what happens when you try to push back against the system that is unfair. Again, shockingly parallel to today. So another one of the labor activists, Louis Lang, died by suicide in jail. Eventually, Governor John Peter Agold pardoned the surviving three because of that judicial injustice. But it took the deaths of most of the men who were arrested for that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So knowing that this is kind of what's going on in the public eye and people are very aware of it, when you're thinking Chicago, people are thinking of this. It's the natural link at that time.
Well, there's death there, so it must be from there.
Yeah, there's all this contention. There's all these problems. It's from Chicago. This was around-ish that time period. But it's very unlikely that that's where the victim was from, because looking at the body, there was no evidence that suggested the person sustained injuries that would have been from the Haymarket affair. And they also didn't match the descriptions of any of the missing labor leaders at that time.
Interesting. But I mean, I see why. If they're like, that crate's from Chicago, that just happened in Chicago. Like, there is a link, but it's not that.
It's a little tenuous, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are the theories. Like, done. End of list.
Yeah, yeah. That had something behind it.
Exactly.
So, in 1926, the retired constable, Dan O'Reilly, claimed he knew the killer, but wouldn't reveal their name because he was protecting a, quote, prominent family. He said that the murderer was dead.
If the murderer did come from a prominent family, it is more likely that even if there was evidence suggesting guilt, it would not have been followed through. I mean, especially like we've got the constable being like, I know who it is. And it's like, dude, just literally your fucking job. Why didn't you do this?
Yeah.
You don't want them to get in trouble, but the murderer probably should. And at the very least, people should be able to know a conclusion to the story. It would also suggest why people were recanting their stories and why people were afraid to come forward. Because if the killer was from a prominent family, then they might know that it was dangerous for them to come forward, especially if the constable was on that family's side.
Yeah. Yeah. Another parallel to today.
Mm-hmm.
If you're rich and famous and own a lot of things, you get away with a lot of stuff.
Gross.
Anyways, although this case is infamous in Connecticut, there have never been more leads or ideas as to who the victim or the murderer may have been. We searched for similar cases and couldn't find anything within 10 years before or after 1886, where a victim who was dismembered was put into a shipping crate like this.
And that feels like a specific MO.
It does.
If you were a person who did this, like, maybe you do it more like that more than once.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so there's nothing that's similar, but it is very strange that just, okay, we don't know who did it. I mean, I guess that happens today too, but yeah.
When we talk about unsolved cases today, it's often the victim's family that's leading the charge to get justice for them.
Yeah.
But if they don't know to be outraged on their loved one's behalf, then they can't do that.
Exactly. Exactly. That's sad. Now, in this area, just interestingly, some people have had paranormal experiences on Shoebox Road. And we mentioned this earlier, but the road where the crate was found is now referred to as Shoebox Road. And Wallingford Ghost Tours even makes a stop there. People have reported some experiences like feeling cold spots, hearing disembodied whispers, feeling like someone is there when they're not, and also flickering lights and orbs.
No.
I mean, I'd be pretty mad if no one ever cared to figure out that I died.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there have been a few different paranormal teams that have gone out there. That would be a place that I would be interested in visiting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To solve it. Poor thing. That's sad. So, what do you think, Lindsay?
I think that it was a person in a prominent family who murdered someone else, perhaps out of jealousy or some personal interaction.
They had a personal vendetta against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wasn't happening a whole bunch. It was just that one time.
Yes.
And dismembering a person is not an easy task to do.
No. And it's messy.
Yeah. And it's messy. You would have to have the space to do it and clean up without anybody seeing you. And I just think that takes a lot of space, too. And the right type of tools. I think it was interesting that they suggested perhaps a butcher.
Yes.
Because they would, like, there would be a reason for them to be covered in blood. They would have all the tools and stuff like that.
They would have it all. Yeah.
But even if they weren't, even if you looked at a prominent family who hunted, they would have tools that too, especially in an area where people were doing farming and it had been recently more rural.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do think prominent family, somebody with the ability to defile the remains in this way.
Yeah.
I think that that's the interesting link here. And the fact that the person's head was never found, that to me speaks to just a more personal killing, and that, like, you want this person erased from the world. You don't even just want them dead. You want them erased.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sad and very heartbreaking to me.
Well, and if the authorities were like, yeah, we know who it is, but all well, like, perhaps the head was found and they just didn't do anything with it or covered it up. But I agree. I think it's just a one-off, like someone didn't like someone for whatever reason. And yeah, because there wasn't more, but they made sure to sort of cover their tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting that, I mean, a random bush, you would think that it's like they wanted it to be found. Like they wanted them to know, well, someone died. You won't know who. And that's kind of another, like, fuck you to them, too. Like, they're going to find your body, but they're not going to know it's you.
Well, and also, like, putting you under shoes. Because keep in mind, the retailer took the shoes out of the box. So whoever did this to the person would have had to have bought shoes to put on top of it. Or they had 12 pairs of shoes lying around. And I just have it. I think it's hard to believe that anybody in that time period would have 12 pairs of shoes.
Yeah, that's sad. And yeah, so the person was just like, their shoes, they'll never know who you are. They're going to find you. They'll never find your head. Or perhaps they got away with it or paid someone off if they were like a prominent family.
It's extra disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
This was a case that Amanda and I have had on our list since the beginning of True Creeps. Like, this was like truly on the list since the beginning.
Yeah.
Think first 6 months of True Creeps, this went on the list. That's how long the list is.
Yeah, the list is pretty intense. But there's another one coming out in a couple weeks that was also on that list. So just a little bit of housekeeping then. We love when people leave us reviews. Thank you to everyone that has. If you plan on leaving a review, take a screenshot of it and send it our way. And we'd be happy to send you a sticker as a thank you. It helps us grow. And then also with spooky season coming up, it would definitely help us grow. And then also, because spooky season's coming up, that means our podiversary is coming up. So we are looking for listener stories. We've already had some sent in, which we love. We have them filed away, ready to go. But if you want to tell us about something weird, spooky, creepy, anything, send it to us. You could go to our website. We have a whole section for it. Or you could simply email it. You can write it out. Or you can record your lovely voice, and we'd be happy to have you on the show.
And just like we did last year, we'll have a limited edition sticker for people who send their listener stories that is unique to this year that you can literally only get by submitting a story. And it can be any creepy, spooky story. It doesn't necessarily have to be a ghost story.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a true crime story. It could be, here's this weird fucking thing that happened to me. Here's my strange connection to this odd thing. Here's a cryptid that I saw. Here's a, I don't know. We've yet to exclude one yet.
Just anything. Yeah, we love all the stories, and we get excited reading them. Like, we've already read, I think we had one or two already sent in, and I was like, oh, this is so good. I can't wait to talk about it. So thank you. If you have it again, it's on our website, or you can just email us. It's truecreepspod@gmail.com. And then also, spooky season means our fall card is coming up as well. So the deadline for that is September 15th. And to receive a fall card, you would join our Patreon, and you can head there through a link on our website or any of our socials. And so if you're looking at which one has the fall card, which tier, that's the Fire Yeti. And so you would get your yearly sticker as well as a fall card if you signed up pretty soon.
Plus part of our Patreon events that we do.
Yeah, everyone that joins. So even if you're at the dollar tier, you get into our exclusive Discord where we were putting some weird stuff in there today.
We were.
People are probably very confused. It's coming up. You'll know in like a week or two.
Yeah, you'll see. You'll see when you see. But because we did our doll chat. So a fun time. A fun time.
Yeah.
Where one of our Patreons recorded with us.
One of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was so fun. But with that, have a great weekend.
Thanks for creeping with us. Thanks for listening. And as always, a special thank you to our patrons who support us via Patreon.
Please see the link in our show notes to learn more about how you, yes you, can begin to haunt the dump, guard vortexes, or even become a scorching Sasquatch.
Also in our show notes, you can find the link to our website, more information on our sources, our social media handles, and our merch store.
We'd love for you to keep creeping with us. So if you like this episode, please subscribe, rate, review, and share the show with your fellow creeps and or ghosts.
I beg of you. Because a train stop, because a train stop,
okay. listen up, scientists and mathematicians. When you are like driving or walking somewhere, do you immediately think if there's like a box or a bag that there's something dead in there?
Not always with boxes, but whenever I see a bag, my brain goes human shaped, not human shaped, human pieces shaped.
Okay.
My brain just automatically does that.
I have to check a box to make sure someone didn't put like a litter of puppies or kittens in there because that's common. And I have found a bag of kittens before.
I was going to say when you said it, I was like, but you've actually had like real world examples where that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, I would too. Tell your chicken cat story.
Yeah. So what Lindsay's referring to is I was training a dog at a dog park once. And this person, like, you parked far away from the dog park. So this person came up with bags and like threw them down and then went back to their car, which wasn't abnormal. Like, usually they'll throw all their stuff down, or if they brought like a chair or something, they'll throw it down, then they'll go get their dog. Well, this person just sped off. And so I was like, what just happened? So I walked over to it, and it was a church's chicken bag of kittens inside. So I had to end my training session immediately and take these kittens in and find them a home. It was crazy.
It also does make me want to be more aware of stopping if I see like a box, like when I'm walking and things like that, just to take a peek in.
Yeah, it was awful. But they are happy. And there's two of them. They both found the home together with one of our really good friends. So they're now named Leslie and April.
Perfect. Little park wreck babes. Immortality sounds like a fucking drag. He knocks on her door wearing a bloodstained shirt and carrying a bundle on his back.
She's like, nothing suspicious here. The palm's over there.
No worries. Yeah, well, so she didn't know where the palm was asking. So she was like, oh, but here's where the nearest river is instead.
She didn't know what the pond was asking?